A frequent criticism of the media coverage of the presidential campaign is that there is too much focus on the horse race story and too little on the issues. Some say that could explain why many, especially younger people, tune out politics. However, Boston University's College of Communication is trying to reach these potential voters. It's developed a smartphone app that seeks to encourage more political involvement. WBUR political reporter Anthony Brooks has the story.
Research bears out the challenge. The younger you are, the less interested in political news you are. Consider these figures from the Pew Research Center. 45% of baby boomers say politics is among the three issues they care about most. Only a third of Gen Xers feel that way, and even fewer millennials do. From a list of 9 topics, just a quarter of millennials put politics and government among their top 3 issues. And given the state of the current political debate, who can blame them?
Hillary Clinton was the worst Secretary of State in the history of the United States.
Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot.
Donald Trump's ideas aren't just different. They are dangerously incoherent.
Attacks and counterattacks, an obsession with polls and process, all of which discourage younger voters from engaging.
We're watching an election cycle where we're literally judging who's the best entertainer, and we've forgotten that at the end of the day, someone has to govern, and if we have to govern, we have to know how we're going to solve problems.
This is Tom Cosgrove, a longtime Boston-based political consultant and organizer. He's the developer of a new smartphone app called Involve, which has the motto, democracy is not a spectator sport.
This is an intersection of civics and journalism to get people to be involved, to take a look, and to play a role in it.
Hillary Clinton is responding to the problem of mass shootings by pushing for what she calls common sense gun restrictions.
I know that we have a majority of Americans and...
The app offers sober and unbiased reports like this one, delivered by veteran Boston newsman R.D. Saul, on a variety of issues, from guns to ISIS to global warming to student debt. There are also longer write-ups and expert interviews on the various campaign issues. Tom Fiedler is the dean of BU's College of Communication, which produces the material and curates the app.
It's a site where anyone can go. We really are hoping that it'll be attractive to young people in particular, and find rigorously gathered and conveniently presented position information about the presidential campaign.
True to its name and mission, Involved also encourages users to get involved by voting on various policy proposals and submitting their own directly to the candidates through social media. Again, Tom Fiedler.
This is particularly important to this generation of young people. They don't want to be on just the receiving side of information that comes to them on high. They want to be able to engage with information and share it. This is what they have grown up with.
Oh, I think it's actually a great idea because me personally, I'm not a huge politics person.
This is Sanaz Tahernia, a journalism grad student at BU. She's one of the student reporters with Involved, which she says is a great way to engage people like her, millennials who might be turned off by politics.
It kind of brings it down to a more understandable, like, layperson's level of political understanding. The interactive element really draws people in, and I think actually it will pique the interest within a lot of people, especially millennials.
Reaching millennials this way makes sense because, not surprisingly, a plurality of them get their news from their smartphones. So do lots of other people. In fact, Johanna Dunaway, an associate professor of communication at Texas A&M University, says in the near future, more than 70% of all online activity will take place on mobile devices like smartphones and tablets. And this concerns her. Dunaway says research suggests that smaller screens and slower wireless connection speeds mean people spend less time engaged with material than they do on a laptop, for example. In other words, smartphones may be a good route to reach millennials, but it might not be encouraging them to go as deeply into the subject matter as they could.
In an already low political knowledge and low civically engaged society, such as here in the U.S., what does it mean if people might be even less likely to seek out and pay attention to news content carefully because we're all on these mobile devices?
That concern may be valid, but R.D. Saul, the veteran Boston newsman who teaches journalism at BU, says involved is an effort to reach younger voters where they live.
They don't watch traditional television newscasts. They don't listen to traditional radio newscasts. They live on their handheld devices, and this is an app that enables them to do that.
Involved has just been launched, so there's no way to measure its popularity or effectiveness yet. But its designers hope that it will provide a new way to engage young voters in substance and solutions rather than sound bites. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
We continue our look this morning at the release of so-called juvenile lifers. Those are people who were teenagers when they were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. After court rulings struck down mandatory life without parole sentences for young people, 11 men have been paroled in Massachusetts over the past 2 years. We've spent time with two of the men. Both are now learning how to navigate a world that's changed dramatically since they first went behind bars. First, Joe Donovan, who's in a car with his father, Joe Donovan Sr.
Take a left, Joe.
Yeah,
we're drive around.
I know where we're going.
Right. I say take a left, he goes right.
This might sound like a typical father-son driving lesson, but student Joe Donovan is 41 years old.
Just be careful.
I see flashing lights in a truck.
This is something new, too, backing out. Watch your mirror, Joe. This guy's backing out, too.
Yeah.
Donovan never thought he would drive. At 17 years old, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the 1992 murder of MIT student Yngwie Raustein. Although Donovan punched Raustein, one of the younger teens Donovan was with fatally stabbed Raustein. But Donovan was the only one considered an adult at the time, so he was sent to prison for life. Now his father, Joe Donovan Sr., is getting to teach his son something he might have 24 years ago.
I'm happy to do this, you know, because we had no idea that he'd ever be out. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. And then when they gave him his parole, I said, oh, there's light again, you know, at the end of the tunnel.
In August of 2014, the Massachusetts Parole Board granted Donovan parole. But before his release, Donovan had to complete 6 months of rehabilitative programming and spend a year in a lower security correctional facility. He moved into a halfway house in Boston in May, and every day, he says, he marvels at his freedom.
I don't really get too stressed out about most stuff because, hey, I don't have somebody coming at me with a knife trying to kill me today. Pretty good day. There's not everybody screaming all the time. There's not every, you know, I'm not sleeping on a metal cot.
While in jail, Donovan took up drawing and won awards for his artwork. Now he's eager to find work where he can move ahead quickly.
When you're now in the age I am, right, which is middle age, I guess, you don't have those opportunities to make the mistakes and the screw-ups and try to find your way in life. I really only have, like, maybe one shot at finding a career.
Another man, recently released after growing up in prison, feels the same way.
I'm 52. I'm going back, like, to where I was before I went into prison. I'm starting all over again.
Greg Diachenko has been working as a custodian in Harvard Square for the past few months. In December, after 34 years in prison, he was released to his mother's home in Boston, where he now has an apartment.
It's immaculate.
Yeah,
your house is
bad.
Immaculate.
Like my cell.
Yeah.
My cell was immaculate. No, everybody used to say, oh, you got the cleanest cell in the block.
Diachenko was convicted of fatally stabbing 55-year-old Thomas Wharf in 1981. His parole hearing documents indicate that when Wharf propositioned Diachenko, Diachenko got into Wharf's car planning to rob him. But when Diachenko showed a knife, Wharf grabbed him and slammed on the horn. Diachenko fought to get free, stabbing Wharf several times. Diachenko describes the murder as the impulsive act of an angry, drunken teen.
You know, I was 17 years old when that terrible crime happened. And it wasn't planned. I didn't wake up that morning and said I was going to go out and kill somebody. It turned into a horrible tragedy. And I hurt a lot of people.
Diachenko says his days on the, quote, outside are routine. He gets up at 5 every day, goes to the gym, to work, and gets long-delayed medical and dental care. He also tries to be a good citizen, with hopes of one day working with at-risk young people to try to prevent more teens from going to prison.
I need to stay focused on my future, you know, and try to do good things in the community. That's what I'd love to do. I'd love to be able to give something back and prove to people that I'm not the monster that a lot of people made me out to be.
After the 2012 U.S. Supreme Court ruling said it was unconstitutional to sentence juveniles to life in prison without parole, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that the estimated 60 juvenile lifers in the state were eligible for parole. In October of 2014, Diachenko won parole, just 2 months after Joe Donovan. Donovan is fighting his lifetime parole because he says he feels he served his sentence. He's also worried that it could make it easier for him to wind up back behind bars, even for a misunderstanding. Donovan says he stays away from crowds, so as much as he likes Fenway Park, he's declined an invitation to a Red Sox game.
There's just such a possibility of it turning in such a bad way, even an innocent situation. You know, I'm on paper as a murderer. If they look it up, right? If they run my name, it's a murderer out. And so, like, they're not going to look at the background story of, like, well, really, you know, he didn't do the crime of murder. The way they're going to look at it is he's a murderer on parole.
Donovan and Diachenko have similar parole conditions. They must meet regularly with a parole officer and a counselor, pay monthly parole fees, and hold steady jobs. They're both still in awe that they've actually been let go from prison. And Diachenko gets emotional, remembering the people he knows who are still incarcerated.
I would like people to know on the inside that I think about them all the time. I don't want to get too emotional, but I think about my fellow lifers all the time. And hopefully...
Sorry, this
it's okay.
Is hard for you.
It is hard. And hopefully laws will change one day that will give them an opportunity to come out here in society and establish themselves and contribute.
Both Diachenko and Donovan say adjusting to their new lives would be near impossible without their strong family support. They also both say they deserved to be punished for their crimes, but they say because most inmates are released, even those who never thought they would be, a greater emphasis on rehabilitation would benefit everyone. To learn more about Greg Diachenko and Joe Donovan and to see photos, go to our website, WBUR.org. This Sunday marks 15 years since the September 11th attacks. Boston's Logan Airport will be forever linked to the attacks. The two planes that hit the Twin Towers in New York left from Logan. Today at the airport, the memory of the people on those planes is honored in a variety of ways. Some are obvious, others are subtle. WBUR's Dan Guzman reports.
Passengers wait for flights inside Terminal B at Logan Airport on a busy September morning. Most are looking for their gates, waiting for flights, or passing the time on their phones.
Ladies and gentlemen, this time we're coming back. It does not fit on the seat in front of you on the Chicago flight here. DB 30 will be checking into your final destination.
Few notice the U.S. flag sitting on top of the jetway at gate B-32. It is a tribute to the passengers and crew of American Airlines Flight 11, which took off from that gate 15 years ago. An hour after it left Boston, the plane slammed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. There is also a flag flying at gate C-19, where United Airlines Flight 175 left before it was commandeered and crashed into the South Tower. Massport CEO Thomas Glynn says while the flags can be seen from the terminals and taxiing planes, airlines have put nothing to note why they are there.
Those who care know, and those... You know, everybody else, it's not a secret, but it's not something that they felt that, you know, they didn't want to look like they were, you know, making a big deal out of something that was supposed to be a sign of respect.
The airlines put the flags up in the weeks after 9/11. When United moved to Terminal B, its employees chose to put up another flag at one of the airline's new gates. Outside of the terminals, on a two-acre site wedged between the main airport roadway and the Hilton Hotel, sits the official Logan 9/11 Memorial. It features two walkways leading up a hill to a 20-by-20 glass cube which contains the names of the people on board the flights from Logan. From above, you can see that the walkways are similar to the flight paths the two planes took on September 11th.
And it was very intentionally meant to be an uplifting experience. It was about moving toward a higher place, a higher, more evolved way of thinking about it.
Robert Lin of Moscow Lin Architects in Boston was one of the designers of the memorial. It opened in 2009 next to the hotel that was used as a gathering place for families in the days after 9/11. The design process took more than a year and included the relatives of people on board the two flights.
Some were more moved than others. You know, some felt that we'd hit it exactly right. Others just felt grateful that their significant others were acknowledged.
The Logan Airport Memorial is a contrast to the National 9/11 Memorial in New York. That site features two waterfalls flowing down into the voids left behind by the fallen towers.
Our particular focus was moving up a hill and moving upward and looking to the sky. And I think that's reflective of Massport's desire to move beyond the tragedy and be able to get to a new way of thinking about what happened here.
One of the most important legacies from 9/11 is One No Passenger Sees, a daily safety meeting at the airport, which Thomas Glynn says began on the morning of September 12, 2001.
That continues every single day, holidays, weekends. That was a good thing that came out of it. The people at the airport are very proud of that it got created in that environment and that it's been sustained.
All action at the airport will pause for a moment at 8:46 Sunday morning, the time American Airlines Flight 11 hit the North Tower. It's a chance for airport workers and passengers to reflect on the anniversary. And after that moment, business will continue as usual. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Dan Guzman.
This week on Morning Edition, we've been talking with two men who grew up in prison. They were sentenced to life for crimes they committed when they were juveniles, but they became eligible for parole after court rulings said automatic life without parole sentences for juveniles are unconstitutional. Joining us to talk further about this is attorney Barbara Cabin. She's former director of juvenile appeals for the state's public defender agency. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the two men we spoke with, 52-year-old Greg Diachenko and 41-year-old Joe Donovan, were both sent to jail at age 17 for murder. They are now out on parole and trying to find their way. Here is a little bit of what Greg Diachenko told us. Let's listen.
I need to stay focused on my future, you know, and try to do good things in the community. I'd love to be able to give something back and prove to people that I'm not the monster that a lot of people made me out to be.
Barbara Cabin, what do we know about the effects of incarceration, especially long-time incarceration, on young people?
Unfortunately, very little. We know that this particular cohort of individuals that are now getting out on parole grew up in prison, and that means that they had to transition from the adolescent who was basically somewhat oppositional, violated the law, obviously did a horrendous crime, but is now trying to figure out what their role is as an adult. And some of them had more opportunities in prison than others, depending on the facility in which they were in. Some of them have more education under their belt than others. But we really don't know a lot about them. And that's part of this whole process that's happening across the country right now. Because when the Supreme Court determined that juveniles can no longer be sentenced to die in prison, we now have a process that says they have to have a meaningful opportunity for release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation.
So, Massachusetts, do we have sort of any kind of guidelines or definition of meaningful release?
No, actually, we don't. That was the phrase that was used in the court decisions, and the courts have not taken it any further to determine what does it mean to be mature when you're in prison? What does it mean to be rehabilitated in prison?
What about psychologically? I mean, you've worked with these folks for a long time. Maybe there isn't research to suggest what might happen to someone who grows up in prison. But I'm wondering what you think.
I guess for me, when I think about it and some of the young men that I've gotten to know, I'm struck by their resiliency. It's an amazing tribute to the human spirit that even in that environment, people grow and change and mature and manage to find a way to be productive citizens.
Both of these men are on parole for life, although Joe Donovan is appealing that. Donovan says that one thing that he's really concerned about is that his record could make it more likely that he would end up back behind bars. So he really avoids any kind of interaction with crowds or the police because he's nervous. Let's hear what he had to say.
There's just such a possibility of it turning in such a bad way, even an innocent situation. You know, I'm on paper as a murderer. If they look it up, right? If they run my name, it's a murderer out. And so, like, they're not going to look at the background story. The way they're going to look at it is he's a murderer on parole.
That sense of vulnerability is real, and I think that it's an appropriate concern in that he carries that mantle with him. They all do. And when you violate parole, it could be a technical violation. It doesn't even have to be a new crime, and you could be brought back in. And it's not a situation where it goes back into court. One of the problems for a lot of the guys is one of the violations is basically fraternizing with other convicts. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, that's been their peer group for so many years, and frequently it's other convicts that have the information to say, listen, this is how you make it in the community.
Both Greg Diachenko and Joe Donovan talked about how difficult it was to find a job. Both of them only got custodial jobs because they knew someone. They said they have no work history, obviously. They've got a criminal record. They've got a lot of blemishes that make it hard for them to move forward. What do you think should be done to help with reentry in these cases?
We have to really develop rehabilitation programs. Our prison facilities do not provide any job skill training. And the way the system has been working up until now, this population could not step down to minimum security or pre-release programs where there's more opportunity to develop vocational skills that might get them better prepared for real jobs. We don't have the services in place. There are not enough reentry programs. There are not enough reentry beds. We have guys getting out that don't have families available to them, that really don't have a place to live.
But overall, you're optimistic about these two men that we spoke with, do you think?
Yes, I am. I'm optimistic about the group as a whole because they recognize how fortunate they are. They do not want to make any mistakes. And you know, what we do have research on is the recidivism rate of murderers in general. In general, murderers have the lowest recidivism rate of any criminal cohort, and juvenile murderers have an even lower rate of recidivism.
Barbara Cabin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.